had a simple choice. He could swim the horrifying rapids below, which would probably kill him, or scale the sheer canyon wall. He was barefoot. The wall was nearly 500 feet tall and completely rotten. It didn't matter. He climbed. The climb took hours. The very worst Ammons can remember. It's been 25 years, and he still has nightmares. McDougal was his best friend and sure to die. It was a gruesome ordeal, but somehow he didn't die. Still, that was it for McDougal. He never paddled big water again. The same cannot be said for Ammons. The following year, he came back to the Stikine with a different crew. Again, passage was not easy. Rocks the size of basketballs were pulling free from the walls and raining down on their boats. Scouting lines required serious climbing skills and considerable imagination. A lot of the time, the closest you can get to a rapid is 300 feet above it, says Ammons. From that height, 15-foot waves look tiny. The only way to solve the puzzle is to astral project yourself down onto the river. Lock that image into your mind and hope you can remember all the different pieces when it counts. Despite the difficulties, the second time turned out to be the charm. Top to bottom in 3 days. The first self-supported trip down the Stikine. In paddling lore, the trip was the rough equivalent of Reinhold Messner summiting Everest without supplemental oxygen. For Ammons, though, it wasn't enough. The rawness of the canyon, the power of the river, the primal forces on such broad display. It spoke to me. The place. The river. It was like a mirror trying to show me something fundamental about myself. Something I desperately needed to know. Which was about the time Doug Ammons started considering a solo expedition down the Stikine. Soloing requires huge commitment. You can't rely on your partners or ask their opinion or even take solace from their presence. There's no support. You can only reach inside yourself for answers. There's a purity there, a stripped-down clarity that demands only one thing. Belonging. To me, that's the essence of good paddling. Belonging to the place. Being a part of it. Merging into it. To be a drop of water on the Stikine. That's what I wanted. That's when the truth would come out.
The Flow Landscape. We'll return to the truth a little later. First, a deeper look at the broader view. Up to now, this audiobook has focused on extreme athletes doing extreme acts, and perhaps it's all a little too extreme. But remember the reason. Action and adventure sport athletes have used flow to accelerate performance faster and farther than almost any other group of people in history. Taking a look at how far they've come gives us a sense of the possible. It provides a benchmark. Yet this doesn't mean these athletes have cornered the market on flow. Far from it. There are a great number of on-ramps into flow, with action and adventure sports being only one of them. For writers, poets, painters, sculptors, dancers, musicians, composers, etc., creativity is their frequent gateway. Scientists and engineers often feel the same. Endurance athletes, meanwhile, can ride pain and exhaustion into the zone. Runner's high is the fabled name for this experience, but it also shows up in swimming, cycling, rowing, hiking, cross-country skiing, and almost any other activity where suffering long distances is a factor. In the world of philanthropy, helper's high is the term for an altruism-triggered flow state, literally brought on by the act of helping another. Originally discovered in the 1990s by Big Brother Big Sister founder Alan Lux in those involved in frontline, hands-on altruism, like volunteering in a soup kitchen, helper's high has since turned up in a far wider range of do-gooder activities, like bidding at a charity auction. There's even a milder flashback version. When people recall their good deeds, a helper's high afterglow can arise. Technology offers even more examples. Video game players get into flow so frequently that Csikszentmihalyi's ideas have become the most widely accepted theoretical framework for explaining the lure of the joystick. Studies have shown that the amount of flow generated by a video game directly correlates to everything from player engagement to overall product success. In fact, as Dr. Eric Gregory, the executive director of the Media Psychology Research Center, wrote in 2007, "Placing players in flow is the key to video gaming's universal appeal." Meanwhile, for internet surfers, researchers have found flow the secret ingredient to almost every aspect of online experience. Both website slipperiness, the ease with which we enter and exit an online experience, and website stickiness, how certain sites hold our attention, are influenced by the state. Researchers at Vanderbilt University have found that from the marketing side of this coin, online flow experiences attract customers, mitigate price sensitivity, and positively influence subsequent buying behaviors. And technology users are only half of this picture, as technology creators have also harnessed this power. "At its best, writing code happens in a state of flow," reads a line in Oracle's Developer Insight series. And it's not just Oracle employees who feel this way. So important has flow become to software development that industry analysts and authors Tom DeMarco and Timothy Lister argue that time-based accounting, paying people for hours worked, needs to be replaced by flow-based accounting, paying people for the amount of time they spend in flow at work. Writing, "The phenomena of flow and immersion give us a more realistic way to model how time is applied to a development task. What matters is not the amount of time you're present, but the amount of time that you're working at your full potential. An hour in flow really accomplishes something, but 10 6-minute work periods sandwiched between 11 interruptions won't accomplish anything." Nor is it just coders. As University of California, Berkeley biophysicist and one of the internet's original architects, Rhys Jones, points out, "All of the basic activities that led to today's high-tech revolution, circuit design, software design, network design, require laser-focused attention and produce flow. And doing any of these tasks well is just not possible without the state." So if you're looking for a non-athletic example of the kind of revolution that occurs when a group of people begin harnessing flow on a regular basis, Silicon Valley is not a bad place to start. But to return to where we started. With flow accessible and important in so many different domains, why does this book focus primarily on action and adventure athletes? Simple. In all these other domains, flow is a luxury. In extreme sports, it is a core requirement. In fact, even though flow is consistently associated with all elite-level athletic success, it's actually rather elusive in traditional sports. Ken Revisa, a psychologist at California State University at Fullerton, who examined instances of flow in bat and ball and track and field sports, and who calls flow by Maslow's name, peak experiences, explains, "The peak experience in sport is a rare personal moment that remains etched in the athlete's consciousness. It serves as a reminder of the great intrinsic satisfaction that sport participation can provide. Peak experiences during an athlete's career are relatively rare, but their intensity acts as a standard, or qualitative reference point, for subjectively evaluating future performance." Again, this is not the case with action and adventure sports. Take a 2000 study run on kayakers on the Class 5 Cheat Canyon in West Virginia. While the subjects included everyone from novice to professional paddlers, meaning it wasn't just extreme athletes involved, researchers found every individual is likely to experience flow at least once while paddling the Cheat Canyon, or, in the case of daily studies, at least once a day. The point is this. If we want more flow in our lives, the best place to start that investigation is with the people with the most flow in their lives. And that is exactly where we're going next. Part one of this audiobook concerned itself with the so-called characteristics of flow, what an individual experiences in the zone. With this stage set, we can now turn our attention to the conditions for flow, the circumstances that speed entrance into the state. Flow triggers is the term we'll be using to describe these circumstances, and over the next four chapters, we'll be examining four varieties: external triggers, internal triggers, social triggers, and creative triggers. But at the heart of all are three critical questions. How have these athletes managed to produce flow so consistently? What are the conditions that led to their success? And how can we bridge the gap between the extreme and the mainstream, importing these conditions into our daily lives? Hacking flow. It wasn't intentional. That's the first thing to know. Certainly, action and adventure athletes have found flow more frequently than most, but much of their success has been accidental. Take external triggers, our starting point. These are qualities in the environment that drive people deeper into the zone. One tamer example comes from office design. In recent years, as the production of flow has been deemed critical to the success of organizations, organizations have reacted by trying to design environments that produce more flow. As flow requires focus, one of the first changes suggested by experts was the removal of cubicle farms, those open office plans that permit constant interruption. These interruptions move us out of flow and increase research and design cycle times and costs dramatically, writes Greylock Partners venture capitalist James Slavitt on Forbes.com. Studies have shown that each time a flow state is disrupted, it takes 15 minutes to get back into flow, if you can get back at all. Yet if focus is the goal, then rearranging office furniture is the long way around. Action and adventure athletes cheat this process with fundamental biology. Evolution hardwired humans to pay attention to certain stimuli more than others. And, as these athletes have discovered, nothing catches our attention quite like danger. Humans evolved in an era of immediacy, where threats were always of the tiger-in-the-bush variety. Immediate threats require immediate responses, and this fact has shaped our brain more than any other. Consider information processing. Every second, our senses gather way more data than we can actually handle. As a result, much of what the brain does is tease apart the critical from the casual. Since nothing is more critical than survival, the first stop most of this incoming information makes is our danger detector, the amygdala. An almond-shaped sliver of the temporal lobe, the amygdala is responsible for primal emotions like hate, anger, and fear. It's our early warning system, an organ always on high alert. With most incoming sensory information heading there, when there's danger lurking in the environment, we don't have to rely on artificial forces like office design to drive attention. Merely by plying their trade in a high-consequence environment, with high consequence being the first of the external triggers we'll be examining, extreme athletes rely on risk to drive focus, the requisite first step toward producing flow. Another way to think about this is hacking. The term comes from electronics, wherein hackers were originally found. The word has since taken on darker connotations. Those interested in tinkering with technology in an attempt to improve performance. In this case, instead of hacking external technologies like computers and telephones, our focus is on hacking internal technologies, our own psychology and neurology. As such, we'll be using flow hack and flow hacker to refer to any action that helps propel people into flow and anyone performing such an action, respectively. In these terms, extreme athletes use risk as a flow hack because flow follows focus and consequences catch our attention. But consequences do more than catch our attention. They also drive neurochemistry. As risk increases, so do norepinephrine and dopamine, the feel-good chemicals the brain uses to amplify focus and enhance performance. Because norepinephrine and dopamine feel really good, playing with this trigger often produces long-lasting effects, Risk takers are transformed into risk seekers. "There was a rush," Doug Emmons once wrote. "And for that moment, we couldn't tell the difference between joy and the grab in our throat, but we knew without saying that it was a new path, and from that point on, nothing seemed the same." Once danger becomes its own reward, risk moves from a threat to be avoided to a challenge to be risen toward. An entirely new relationship with fear begins to develop. When risk is a challenge, fear becomes a compass, literally pointing people in the direction they need to go next. That is, the direction that produces more flow. "If you're interested in mastery," says University of Cambridge, England neuropsychologist Barbara Sahakian, "you have to learn this lesson. To really achieve anything, you have to be able to tolerate and enjoy risk. It has to become a challenge to look forward to. In all fields, to make exceptional discoveries, you need risk. You're just never going to have a breakthrough without it." When these athletes actually take a risk, putting themselves in a high-consequence situation rather than a high-risk environment, an even bigger neurochemical response is facilitated. Risk-taking itself releases another big squirt of dopamine, further enhancing performance and increasing pattern recognition. Once the pattern recognition system lights on to the proper response, that is, identifies the chunk that will save the athlete's hide in this particular situation, even more dopamine is released, and the cascade continues. As we know these facts, we also know a bit about hacking the high-consequence flow trigger. For starters, risk is always relative. While some danger must be courted for flow, confrontations with mortality are not required. In fact, even physical risk itself is optional. A shy man need only cross the room to say hello to an attractive woman to trigger this rush. In casual conversation, merely telling someone the truth can serve the same purpose. "To reach flow," explains Harvard psychiatrist Ned Hollowell, "one must be willing to take risks. The lover must lay bare his soul and risk rejection and humiliation to enter this state. The athlete must be willing to risk physical harm, even loss of life, to enter this state. The artist must be willing to be scorned and despised by critics and the public and still push on. And the average person, you and me, must be willing to fail, look foolish, and fall flat on our faces should we wish to enter this state." What all of this adds up to is options. Certainly, risk is needed for flow. But if you don't want to take physical risks, take mental risks. Take social risks, emotional risks, creative risks, especially creative risks. The application of imagination, one very shorthand definition of creativity, is all about mental chance-taking. And the risk is real. Loss of respect, loss of resources, loss of time. The consequences of betting on a bad idea can certainly threaten survival. Yet, if we're going to hack flow by trading mental risks for physical risks, and especially if we want the same kind of accelerated performance seen today in extreme athletes, then our commitment to the process better be ferocious. Why? Because today's action and adventure athletes aren't just occasionally pulling the high-consequence flow trigger. They're squeezing hard, and all the time. Action and adventure sports are packed with do-or-die moments. Traditional athletics, in contrast, are cushioned by the artifice of the game. In basketball, the only time one can launch a game-winning buzzer beater, the riskiest shot, is in the last seconds of play. And the worst thing that can happen if that shot goes wide? Being benched for the next game. But action and adventure sports have an unflinching referee, the laws of physics. A surfer who doesn't commit completely to every inch of a big wave ends up begging for mercy at the bottom of the impact zone. Thus, if we want the accelerated performance of these athletes, we need their ferocious commitment as well. More than that, we need to understand that risk is only the first of our external triggers, And flow hackers have plenty more choices available. In fact, it was these additional choices that Emmons was counting on to help him survive the Stikine. Rich environment, deep embodiment. It's not easy to get to the Stikine. Start in Washington and head north. Drive 600 miles of empty gravel road, not a soul in sight. Plenty of time to think. In the fall of 1992, Doug Emmons drove those miles alone. So what was he thinking? "No one knew where I was or what I was doing," he says. "I was thinking, if this went wrong, they would never find my body." Emmons didn't care. He'd come for the consequences. He knew how to leverage risk to access flow and, critical for this mission, believed he could remain in the state for a very long time. "I had no choice," he says. "The Stikine is 3 days worth of relentless. It runs class 5 between rapids. Portaging requires big wall climbing and rappelling. Scouting requires heightened awareness and really good problem-solving skills. None of this is possible without flow. You can't control this river. You can't muscle through it. You have to become part of it. You have to flow with it." Emmons was betting his life on the ability to summon and maintain one of the most elusive states on Earth. A hefty wager, to say the least. Yet he could place this bet with confidence because he wasn't only relying on risk to trigger flow. He was also depending on two other external triggers, rich environment and deep embodiment, to keep him in the state. A rich environment is a combination platter of novelty, unpredictability, and complexity. Three elements that catch and hold our attention, much like risk. Novelty means both danger and opportunity. To our forebears, a strange scent in the wind could be prey or predator. But either way, it paid to pay attention. Unpredictability means we don't know what happens next. Thus, we pay extra attention to what happens next. Complexity, when there's lots of salient information coming at us at once, does more of the same. In fact, most of us have some familiarity with complexity triggering flow. If you've ever stood before a vast canyon and felt awe, well, awe is a state of total absorption and the front end of flow. When sucked in by the incomprehensible complexity of geologic timescales and epic beauty, reality pauses, if only for a moment. And in this moment, we taste the pinpoint focus, loss of self-consciousness, and time dilation that are deep zone companions. Action and adventure athletes taste these experiences so often because nature is jam-packed with novelty, unpredictability, and complexity. Rivers are living entities. Same with the mountains and the waves. The Alaskan snowpack morphs on a moment-to-moment basis. The swells of Chopu lurch to their own rhythms. In places where anything can happen, a wandering mind is a dangerous mind. Thus, rich environments automatically tighten focus and drive flow. And for those of us who want to take advantage of this fact, yet have no interest in action and adventure sports? Simple. Seek out complexity, especially in nature. Go stare at the night sky. Walk in the woods. If you can't find big nature, contemplate the small. The reasons there are so many clichés about universes inside of dewdrops is because there are universes inside of dewdrops. No dew to contemplate? Use technology to induce awe. Surf your city with Google Earth, or go see an IMAX movie. Next, up novelty and unpredictability. Normally, we go out of our way to avoid both. We rely on old habits. We cherish our routines. And why not? Automatic pilot is efficient. Routines save the brain energy. And who hasn't driven to work without remembering the trip? Yet vary the route next time. Brush your teeth with the wrong hand. These against-the-grain tricks increase novelty and unpredictability, demanding focus and pattern recognition. And both are the real goal. You don't need a giant wave or a big mountain to trigger these responses, says neuroscientist and director of the Krasnow Institute for Advanced Study at George Mason University, James Olds. The brain's reaction isn't dependent on real external information. It's reacting to a constellation of inputs from the sensory system. If you can light up that same constellation, say, replace the novelty found in a natural environment with new routines in your daily life, you'll get the dopamine and norepinephrine. This is why the flow hack of the 22nd century is going to be a button on your augmented cognition device that lights up this same constellation. Olds, by the way, practices what he preaches, driving a different route home from work every day. The last external flow trigger, deep embodiment, is a kind of full-body awareness. Humans have sensory inputs all over the place. 50% of our nerve endings are in our hands, feet, and face. We have as many neurons in the gut and heart as in the brain. We also have proprioception to detect position in space and vestibular awareness for balance. Deep embodiment means paying attention to all of these sensory inputs at once. More inputs means more information. Way more information. The brain can't process this deluge consciously. Too slow. Too inefficient. In many situations, too dangerous. When critical data arrives via fire hose, there's no time for a neurotic debate. Tasks that require real-time sensory-motor integration are best handled by the implicit system, explained Arne Dietrich in a 2011 paper for Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews. Explicit interference into the execution of these kinds of tasks tends to decrease their effectiveness. Deep embodiment, then, is the transient hypofrontality fast track, and thus another reason action and adventure athletes have found flow so frequently. Action and adventure sports demand deep embodiment, says Ammons, especially kayaking. Big rivers accelerate you in every direction at once. This puts the vestibular system into overdrive. This isn't just your mind paying more attention. Suddenly your entire body is paying attention. When this happens, it's outside our conscious capabilities. There are no words. Our language becomes that of the river. All the features of the river speak to you, and you to them through motion. There is tension, threat, there is joy and release, and overall, a deep, deep sense of flow. You are literally part of the flow of the world. If we want to pull the deep embodiment trigger in less extreme environments, then we simply have to learn to pay attention to all of these input streams. This isn't hard. Zen walking meditation teaches an open senses, all senses awareness. Balance and agility training, like playing hopscotch or running ladder drills, enhance proprioception and vestibular awareness. Yoga, Tai Chi, and just about every martial art blend both together. And if technology is more your speed, there are video games for both Xbox's Kinect and Nintendo's Wii that do the same. Emmons, meanwhile, was counting on all of these external triggers to survive the Stikeen. He knew all three would be present the moment his boat hit the water. No longer on land, deep embodiment, alone in one of the largest and most isolated wildernesses on the planet, rich environment, and closing in on Entry Falls, the first major rapid and the place Bob McDougall almost died. High consequence. Without question, he was primed for flow. The paradox of control. Yet it wasn't until Wicked Wanda, the Stikeen's third major rapid, that Ammons felt the state's full embrace. A steep ramp, an evil hole. A pummeling wave train run out. Wanda's is wicked, all right. Ammons got spun upside down somewhere between the ramp and the hole. It could have been a disaster. It was a blessing in disguise. When he rolled to right himself, he rolled right into flow. Up to that point, he says, it was taking everything to hold it together. I was so far out there, totally alone. The intimidation factor was keeping me out of flow. But rolling required deep embodiment, and that did the trick. Halfway through the roll, I just snapped into the state. Just in time. Located a few rapids downstream was Wasson's, what legendary kayaker Jerry Moffat calls a million-dollar hole. Meaning, he says, most people wouldn't paddle it for $1 million. But there's no retreat. Wasson's is surrounded by vertical cliffs, so portaging, hiking upstream, or climbing out are impossible. It's do or die. For Ammons, it was almost die. Wasson's has two big disaster features that have to be avoided, he says. But there was no line. The right side and the center were North Shore impact zones, just incredibly violent. Everything was punching left, pushing into the main hole. No matter what I did, I was 99% sure I would be annihilated. Ammons was out of options. He let himself get swallowed. It was the most unbelievable sensation. This thing I knew was impossible, that just couldn't work. I got to watch myself piece it together. I could feel all of the river's reactions and could feel myself melding with them. My goal was to do this inconceivable thing, to be a drop of water. Surviving Wasson's was proof I had done it. From that point on, I knew the impossible was possible. The sensation Ammons is describing is the paradox of control, another of Flo's defining characteristics. The paradox is real power in places we should have none. It's that sense of controlling the uncontrollable, familiar to day traders and emergency room surgeons, only here taken to its farthest extreme. What creates this feeling is a two-part contradiction. Part one, Flo is exceptionally pleasurable, but mostly in retrospect. It is this absence of emotion, of almost any kind of conscious awareness of one's state, that is at the heart of Flo, writes University of Pennsylvania psychologist Martin Seligman. Consciousness and emotion are there to correct your trajectory. When what you are doing is seamlessly perfect, you don't need them. Part two. You may be unemotional, but you're not asleep. In the throes of the paradox, you're fully aware of the ass you're kicking, just not entirely certain you deserve all the credit. Ammons agrees. There aren't any words to describe this feeling. Too frequently, athletes fall back on cliches and machismo. They paddle something hard, and when someone puts a microphone in their face, all they can come up with is, "I tamed that bitch." But when you're actually in those moments, if you're going to survive, nobody is arrogant. You have to be humble and open to access this control. Of course, since most people's knowledge of action and adventure sports comes from energy drink ads, and blending with the environment doesn't really move product, we're sold this extreme dude lie instead. But the extreme dude lie is hiding a potent flow hack. Humility. When you're arrogant and egotistical, says Dr. Olds, you're shutting out complexity, novelty, and unpredictability to preserve a distorted self-image. Any incoming information that could lead to self-doubt is stamped out. It's a massive data reduction. Humility moves in the other direction. It opens us up and increases incoming information. As a result, there is more opportunity for pattern recognition, more dopamine, and less need for judgmental metacognition. Ammons stayed humble and stayed in the zone. He survived Wasson's and went on to survive the Stikine. For those keeping score, he made only two portages along the way. One around V-Drive, a death trap rapid that would remain unrunnable until 2001, when the river shifted a boulder. And the upper half of Site Z, which, with help from near-perfect conditions and a sizable support team, was finally run in 2012. Yet, despite the magnitude of his accomplishment, it would be a very long time before anyone heard the tale.
Besides his wife and two close friends, Ammons told no one for 18 years. Since then, other than a short essay and a few incidental mentions, this is the first time many details have seen print. He's also refused to profit from the experience, turning down a long list of film deals and sponsorship opportunities. In fact, in the history of action and adventure sports, the Stikine Solo may be the greatest story never told, and one of the few times someone has pulled off the impossible and flat out refused to use it for personal gain. Humility matters. On a final note, it's been over 2 decades, but no one has yet to repeat Emmons Solo. 7. Inner Flow. Mandy Ray Cruikshank and the Now. Mandy Ray Cruikshank never intended to become a superhero. She grew up shy in the suburbs of Alberta, Canada. She was exceptionally shy. Way too timid to give book reports in school, she failed projects rather than face fears. During lunch or recess, even when all her friends were together, she was too bashful to go over and say hello. The only place Mandy Ray ever felt comfortable was the water. While her aquatic passion blossomed into competitive synchronized swimming in high school, her coach made a point of telling her parents that she had no future in the sport, lacking, apparently, the requisite drive to take things to the Olympic level. "By the time I got out of high school," says Cruikshank, "it was pretty clear to me and to most who knew me that I was never going to do anything groundbreaking." On her way to never, and capitalizing on her passion for water, Cruikshank opened a scuba shop in Vancouver. She soon became friendly with another dive operation owner, Kirk Kroc, and he introduced her to the ancient sport of free diving. Arguably the simplest athletic pursuit in the world, free diving, or diving without a breathing apparatus, that is, scuba tanks, requires only a body and a breath. Divers suck in nearly as much air as possible, then descend into the depths of the ocean. Sometimes they use fins. Sometimes they go barefoot. Occasionally, weights are involved. And every now and again, the big blue is traded for the shallow end of the pool and divers compete in static apnea, essentially hanging limp in the water to see who can hold their breath the longest. There are dangers, of course. When outside pressure crushes inside airspaces, the results can be exceptionally painful. Eardrums rupture with regularity. The biggest threat is blacking out, which can happen because of low oxygen, high carbon dioxide, loss of blood pressure, or several other factors. It's for all of these reasons that, as Alec Wilkinson explained in the pages of The New Yorker, free diving is frequently described as the world's second most dangerous sport, after jumping off skyscrapers with parachutes. Kroc himself discovered free diving accidentally. His early expertise was in mixed gas deep scuba, but in the late 1980s, while running a dive shop in the Caymans, he had taken to skin diving, as the term free diving didn't yet exist, on his days off. With a little practice, he found himself capable of holding his breath long enough to play around at depths of 60 to 100 feet. The real change occurred in 1997, when Pepin Ferreira, then one of the few professional free divers in the world, decided to set a new world record in the Caymans and asked Kroc, whose dive shop owned all the necessary equipment, to help him out. "I had zero free diving technique at the time," recounts Kroc. "But I watched Pepin prepare for his dive, and he started by doing pull-downs, descending about 30 feet, hanging out for a while, then popping back up. He did this a few times. Back then, all I did was dive as deep as possible right away. Using my technique, after a few hours, I found that the length of time I could hold my breath increased considerably. When I tried doing Pepin's pull-downs, I got the kinds of breath holds that used to take hours to achieve in minutes." Kroc had uncovered a technique for triggering the mammalian diving reflex,
a reflex that optimizes respiration and, like dolphins, whales, and some birds, allows us to operate underwater for extended periods of time. Here's how it works. When the nerves of the human face come in contact with water, our heartbeat begins to slow, 10 to 30% in amateurs, up to 50% in professionals. A slower heart rate requires less oxygen, leaving more left over for other organs. Next, as pressure from depth increases, blood leaves our extremities. First, fingers and toes, next, hands and feet, finally, arms and legs, and surrounds the heart and brain. Lastly, during deeper dives, organs and circulatory walls allow blood plasma and water to pass through them, preventing the chest cavity from collapsing inward with the massive pressure increase. While the mammalian diving reflex was first discovered by Navy scientists back in the 1960s, so small were free diving circles, it remained a well-kept secret until here in the 21st century. But Kroc got obsessed. He learned everything he could about the reflex, built training programs around the ideas, then opened Performance Freediving International. He taught folks about peak inhalations, filling all pulmonary air spaces, and packing, taking in tiny sips of air after the lungs had been filled, which, if done wrong, can lead to broken ribs, punctured tracheas, and quick blackouts. And breathe-ups, a way to lower heart rate, increase blood oxygen, and dispel carbon dioxide. He got very good at this teaching. By the time he was getting to know Cruikshank, Kroc had already coached both Brett Leemaster and Tanya Streeter to world records. Kroc and Cruikshank soon found themselves romantically intertwined. They're now married with children. And this proved a boon for Mandy Ray's training. The mammalian diving reflex is inhibited by stress, so being comfortable in the water is a considerable advantage when trying to learn the technique. Cruikshank was a natural. Even more important was her ability to equalize at depth. "I had never been below 36 meters before," she recounts. "But in early 2000, I got a chance to go deep on a tandem no-limits dive." No limits means she was towed downward by a weighted sled and relied on an airbag to return her to the surface. "That's how I found out I had no trouble equalizing at 100 meters. When Kirk realized this, he decided we were going for a world record." Thus, in the Caymans, and roughly 18 months after first taking up freediving, Mandy Ray took a very short boat ride out to the competition area, really nothing more than a square of ocean marked off by buoys, grabbed hold of that weighted sled once again, and let herself be dragged to depth. If only it were that easy. Sure, in no limits, the sled and the airbag do all the work. But that turns the trip into a purely mental game. "Physically," says Cruikshank, "all that's required is you hang on and go for a ride. Mentally, it's like playing chess against yourself. It's will and technique versus panic and pressure. It's about forcing the mind to stop thinking. It's about flow. If you can't get into flow, if you can't melt into the water, become part of the water, then you can't free dive. There's just no other way to go deep." This mental game is especially hard for Cruikshank, a self-described head case. "From the moment I get out of bed to the moment I go to sleep," says Cruikshank, "my brain never turns off. So when I dive, it's really important that I don't let myself get consumed. But Kirk showed me I could do the impossible. That changed something inside of me. I became compelled. I had a reason to win the fight against my brain. I had to find out what else was possible. I had to find out if I was capable of doing something no one else in the world could do, something nobody had ever done before." Turns out, she could. On September 23rd, 2001, Cruikshank set her first world record, a 136-meter no-limits descent. The following year, she set a second world record for a 6-minute, 16-second static apnea breath hold. A year after that, it was No Fin's constant ballast. Divers descend and ascend with weights and under their own power, world record of 41 meters, and she was just getting warmed up. In total, Cruikshank set 7 world records in 7 years, including her March 24, 2004 constant ballast, this time with fins, breakthrough of 78 meters. "That was the one people will always remember," says Croc. "She beat the previous record by 10 meters. It was a huge jump, one of the largest single jumps in the history of the sport." Cruikshank explains it differently. "I'm just an ordinary woman who learned she was capable of extraordinary things." Internal flow triggers. The question raised by Mandy Ray Cruikshank is fairly straightforward. How did she learn she was capable of extraordinary? Turns out, she didn't learn how to do anything. Mandy Ray learned when. When she was capable of extraordinary. This made all the difference. Mandy Ray took up an activity that demanded she live in the now. Not metaphorically. Not in some groovy hippie way. Quite simply, 300 feet underwater, there's no way to be elsewhere. When she says, "It's really important to not let myself get consumed," she means, when diving, not thinking about the future, where she could run out of air, or the past, where a poor decision made her use up too much air, is survival. Instead, Cruikshank has trained herself to keep attention right here, right now, which is the only time flow can show up and the only time we're capable of extraordinary. Yet the here and now isn't seen much these days. In our always-on, hyper-connected world, there are endless reasons to be elsewhere. Every time we answer an email or return a text or check our Facebook page, we are there and not here. And just as frequently, we are then and not now. With inboxes piling up, today's luncheon, tonight's parent-teacher conference, tomorrow's deadlines, the report due next week, the performance review right after that, well, no wonder we can't live in the moment. Instead, as Douglas Rushkoff writes in Present Shock, we tend to exist in a distracted present, where forces on the periphery are magnified and those immediately before us are ignored. Our ability to plan, much less follow through on it, is undermined by our need to be able to improvise our way through any number of external impacts that stand to derail us at any moment. Instead of finding a stable foothold in the here and now, we end up reacting to an ever-present assault of simultaneous impulses and commands. Not only is the distracted present a miserable place to be, it's also the worst kind of self-handicapping. Study after study shows that we're terrible multitaskers. By trying to improve performance by being everywhere and every when, we end up nowhere and never. The sad truth is that our lives are pulling us in every direction save the one where we're most effective. Worse, as anyone who has ever attempted meditation has quickly discovered, changing this tendency is not easy. Using the mind to silence the mind is a long-term endeavor. Tibetan Buddhist meditators, who have arguably self-selected for this ability, can spend over 2 decades learning to wield it reliably. Yet Mandy Ray's ascension didn't take decades. It didn't even take years. She went from absolute beginner to world record holder in 18 months. And why? She took a shortcut into the now. Just as flow states have external triggers, conditions in the outer environment that create more flow, they also have internal triggers, conditions in our inner environment that create more flow. Internal triggers are psychological strategies that drive attention into the now. Back in the 1970s, Csikszentmihalyi identified clear goals, immediate feedback, and the challenge-skill ratio as the 3 most critical. Let's take a closer look. Clear goals that define immediate success is how this first trigger is typically described. Generally, the thinking's been that clear goals help identify our task, so we know what to do, and align that task with belief, so we know why we're doing it. But the most important piece, as University of Illinois cognitive scientist Daniel Simons discovered, is how clear goals impact attention. In 2003, Simons showed a short film of basketball players passing a ball around a court to his students and asked them to count the passes. When the film was over, he had one question. How many people saw the gorilla? As it happened, midway through the clip, a guy in a gorilla costume walked to the middle of the circle of basketball players, beat his chest a few times, then walked off. As it happened, most of the students didn't see the gorilla. Simon's invisible gorilla experiment has since been repeated dozens of times, most recently with radiologists looking at radiological screens and a cartoon gorilla. And always with the same result. Not many people see the gorilla. In the radiologist's version, a 2012 study run at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, 83% of doctors tested failed to spot the animal. The point is this. When the brain is charged with a clear goal, focus narrows considerably. The unimportant is disregarded, and the now is all that's left. Just as important, in the now, there's no past or future, and a lot less room for self, which are the three intruders most likely to yank us to the then. This also tells us something about emphasis. Philip Zimbardo pointed out that Western society is dominated by futures, that is, those well-trained to strive for goals. Thus, when considering clear goals, most have a tendency to skip over the adjective clear to get to the noun, goals. When told to set clear goals, we immediately visualize ourselves on the Olympic podium, the Academy Award stage, or the Fortune 500 list, saying, I've been picturing this moment since I was 15, and think that's the point. It's not the point. Those podium moments can pull us out of the present. Even if success is seconds away, it's still a future event subject to hopes, fears, and all sorts of now-crushing distraction. Think of the long list of infamous sporting chokes, the dropped pass in the final seconds of the Super Bowl, the missed putt at the end of the Augusta Masters. In those moments, the gravity of the goal pulled the participants out of the now, when, ironically, the now was all they needed to win. If creating more flow is our aim, then the emphasis falls on clear and not goals. Clarity gives us certainty. We know what to do, and we know where to focus our attention while doing it. When goals are clear, metacognition is replaced by in-the-moment cognition, and the self stays out of the picture. When I dive constant ballast, says Mandy Ray Cruikshank, I don't think about breaking a record. I can't ever think about the whole dive. It's too overwhelming. I have to chunk it down, create tiny, clear goals. I go through kick cycles. The voice of intuition, keeps count. I want to pay attention through one cycle, then the next, then the next. Keep the count. That's my only goal. If I keep the count, I can stay in flow the whole dive. Applying this idea in our daily life means breaking tasks into bite-sized chunks and setting goals accordingly. A writer, for example, is better off trying to pen three great paragraphs at a time, the equivalent of moving through Mandy Ray's kick cycles, rather than attempting one great chapter. Think challenging, yet manageable. Just enough stimulation to shortcut attention into the now, not enough stress to pull you back out again. Immediate feedback, our next internal trigger, is another shortcut into the now. The term refers to a direct, in-the-moment coupling between cause and effect. The smaller the gap between input and output, the more we know how we're doing and how to do it better. If we can't course correct in real time, we start looking for clues to better performance. Things we did in the past. Things we've seen other people do. Things that can pull us out of the moment. When feedback is immediate,
The information we require is always close at hand. Attention doesn't have to wander. The conscious mind need not get involved. Of course, for action and adventure athletes, getting the information they require is automatic. As National Outdoor Leadership School, NOLS, founder Paul Petzold once said, "In the mountains, feedback is instant." Same with the rivers, rocks, and oceans. In these environments, the laws of physics deliver instantaneous, unmediated feedback. No judges, no scorecards, no review in the New York Times. Just cause and effect. Either Mandy Ray holds her breath at depth, or she blacks out trying. This automatic feedback is another reason extreme athletes have found flow so frequently. But what if we're interested in pulling this trigger without help from the laws of physics? No mystery here. Tighten feedback loops. Put mechanisms in place so attention doesn't have to wander. Ask for more input. How much input? Well, forget quarterly reviews. Think daily reviews. Studies have found that in professions with less direct feedback loops, stock analysis, psychiatry, and medicine, even the best get worse over time. Surgeons, by contrast, are the only class of physician that improve the longer they're out of medical school. Why? Mess up on the table and someone dies. That's immediate feedback. And that brings us to the challenge-skill ratio, the last of our internal flow triggers, and arguably the most important. The idea behind this trigger is that attention is most engaged, that is, in the now, when there's a very specific relationship between the difficulty of a task and our ability to perform that task. If the challenge is too great, fear swamps the system. If the challenge is too easy, we stop paying attention. Flow appears near the emotional midpoint between boredom and anxiety, in what scientists call the flow channel, the spot where the task is hard enough to make us stretch, but not hard enough to make us snap. How hard is that? Answers vary, but the general thinking is about 4%. That's it. That's the sweet spot. If you want to trigger flow, the challenge should be 4% greater than the skills. In technical terms, the sweet spot is the end result of what's known as the Yerkes-Dobson law, the fact that increased stress leads to increased performance up to a certain intensity, beyond which performance levels off or declines. In real-world terms, it's not much at all. In most situations, we blow by 4% without even noticing. But this is not the case in extreme sports. In the big waves, big rivers, and big mountains, a half degree of difficulty can mean the difference between home for dinner and never home again. Under these conditions, the desire for improvement keeps athletes from understepping, and the need for survival from overstepping. This sweet spot keeps attention locked in the present. When the challenge is firmly within the boundaries of known skills, meaning I've done it before and am fairly certain I can do so again, the outcome is predetermined. We're interested, not riveted. But when we don't know what's going to happen next, we pay more attention to the next. Uncertainty is our rocket ride into the now. It's also for this reason that uncertainty causes the brain to release dopamine. A lot of dopamine. When anything can happen, survival could be at stake. Dopamine heightens attention and pattern recognition. Two things that are absolutely essential to dealing with the unknown. Of course, being dopamine, this is all exceptionally pleasurable. Or, as Stanford neurologist Robert Sapolsky likes to say, maybe, meaning uncertainty, is addictive like nothing else out there. And maybe is also the only road to impossible. This is why the challenge-skill ratio is so important. If we want to achieve the kinds of accelerated performance we are seeing in action and adventure sports, then it's 4% plus 4% plus 4%, day after day, week after week, months into years into careers. This is the road to real magic. Follow this path long enough,
And not only does impossible become possible, it becomes what's next. Like eating breakfast. Like another day at the office. Miles Dasher,